Hi and welcome to Wunderbar Together. My name is Felix Zeltner. I'm a New York-based German journalist and the co-founder of Work Awesome. On this podcast, we take you on a journey to the coolest Germans in the United States. And we learn together how they combine cultures to create something wonderful. Today, my co-host Olli Nämmerich from Cologne, Germany, is joining me on the podcast again. Olli, great to see you, great to hear you. We're connected on Zoom as it goes these days. Olli, what was your last creative project?
Hello there. My latest creative challenge actually was how to handle this podcast project next to my regular agency job and my 3-month-old son. Baby. Yeah, this is quite a challenge. But I think I did it nicely in a creative way.
Congratulations again on becoming a dad. And I asked you this weird question, like, what was your latest creative project? Because today on Wunderbar Together, it's really all about creativity. Because we're being joined by a creative mastermind who officially serves as, and I ask you to really listen to this title, Google's Chief Innovation Evangelist. Frederik Pferd is also an adjunct professor at Stanford University, and we're so honored to have him on the podcast. Welcome, Frederik.
Hi, Felix. Hi, Oliver. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. You have quite a family as well, as I have learned. How are you doing? Where are you joining us from? And how are your kids and your partner in the current situation?
Fantastic. I'm actually doing fantastic, I have to say. So thank you for asking. I'm joining you today from my geodesic dome in our little forest here in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's actually called the Friends Dome. So this is where I spend now most of my time, working from home, connecting with friends, connecting with family, but also connecting, you know, with myself and with nature and so forth. My kids are down in the house. Some of them are playing, others are on video conferencing with, you know, grandparents. They do one lesson a day with grandmas and grandpas. They take turns. And my wife is actually out for a run.
Nice. And may I ask you once again where you are? Because you were mentioning a dome. So please take us into this very special structure that you are currently in and take our listeners into understanding what this actually looks like.
Yes. So geodesic domes have been around for quite some time. I think Buckminster Fuller is one of the masterminds and the architects behind those futuristic shapes and architectural structures. And it's set up like a tent in my backyard. I have kind of technology built in. I have a little robot that drives around here. I have a bed, kind of like a loft bed here, so people can actually stay overnight. And I have a wood burning stove, a little fridge. And other kind of elements here. I can make my own tea up here. I have water supply and so forth. And I have quite a good view as well into the nature. So that also helps me to take a couple of deep breaths in the morning coming up here before I start my workday, connecting with my team and with other folks around the world through our technology. And it really is a fantastic place also for the kids to hang out and to do their schoolwork as well. So it's a great way of living and playing and working together, probably in a different way. And interestingly, just a short story here, about 6 months ago, BC, I think that's what we call it now, pre-COVID or before COVID, I somehow, wanted to build a new work environment for myself and really try to maybe anticipate a little bit that work might be different in the future, right? And how we work might be very different. So I built this kind of like geodesic dome, not really knowing that, you know, obviously the future will actually put us all in lockdown and put us in a situation where we are forced to work from home. But really try to see that as an opportunity to work differently, right? And really, you know, reduce the commute time to work, but also have a dedicated space for myself to really, you know, engage with other people around the world through technology. And I have to say, like a couple of months later, it was the perfect setup, I think, for me. And I'm finding myself really lucky to be able to, you know, walk a couple of minutes up here every morning, you know, do a quick kind of like mindfulness break. And also just being able to have a dedicated space to do my work and really get myself into a different mindset as well. Because I truly believe that our environments and how we live and play in those environments really shape how we think and feel.
Frederick, before we dive into your journey, and Ollie will help us a little bit to understand where you're coming from in Germany, I have one more question about the pandemic and the lockdown that put you into this kind of glamping situation that you have envisioned for yourself months before this pandemic started, which is so fascinating, and it just shows how much ahead of the curve you are. As we are all parents on this podcast today, Ollie just had his first child together with his partner just a couple of months ago. You have three children. I have two children. I have seen a lot of challenges for children in this time. They're losing their social environment. They're losing their contact to friends. They have to adjust to e-learning, which in many ways is not where it should be. How have you managed, with all that you know about creativity, about learning, about, you know, motivating people, how have you dealt with your children? And maybe you have even some advice on what you have learned over the last couple of weeks and how to treat children in a special environment and situation like this one.
That's a great question, Felix. I try to look at these things as opportunities, right? So probably like everyone else, over the past couple of months, we learned a lot, right? We learned, for example, that the future is ambiguous and uncertain by definition, right? And we also learned that everything comes different and probably unexpected in some way, in some form, right? So most of us were surprised in like what situation are we going to find ourselves in and are finding ourselves now in. I think one major lesson was that the world experienced probably like a turbo boost, right, in so many areas. And the level of creativity and innovation, something people experimented with in so many different things and in so many different ways, was just remarkably high. So most importantly, we learned that you can turn most problems into opportunities. And the bigger the problem, the bigger the opportunity. But you have to set your mind towards that. You have to shift your mindset to really see not just the challenge, but see the opportunity. So when you talk about, you know, children now being at home and not being able to go to school, I see that as an opportunity. I see that as an opportunity that we now actually see that technology in education is accelerating and that we are making progress around e-learning and distance learning and so forth that we should have made probably like years or even decades ago. And so for me, it's a great opportunity to also turn that into an opportunity where we see like now we can actually look into like, you know, grandparents and other parts of the family and how they can play a role in educating our kids, right? And what that role could look like. For example, my kids receive every day 1 hour of education, right? In some form or some way through online learning with their grandparents, right? And so my mother is preparing kind of like lessons every day. She's not a teacher, but she's super passionate, super excited to engage, you know, with my three children. And she does a wonderful job in kind of like, you know, teaching them things, right? Relevant things, meaningful things.
Can you name an example for what your mother is currently teaching your kids?
Many things. Like, you know, I have, a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 10-year-old. So there's different levels of, you know, obviously education and what she does with kids. So from coloring and like, you know, easy math to kind of like social skills, right? What compassion and empathy means, right? Also talking about race, right? For example, talking about different ethnicities, different religions, different parts of the world, talking about history, and how that shapes our cultures. So many different things. And I'm super excited to see that, you know, we now have this opportunity where we actually allow our parents to play a bigger role in educating, you know, our kids, right? And so I see that as an opportunity. Also, the way kind of like my kids now use technology, right? Just in a very natural way. They always have been kind of like quite keen around technology and have been using that, but now doing that for an educational purpose, right? It's really interesting to see. And also I see some shifts in the educational model as well, where teachers spend more time actually helping children to connect on a deeper level, right? Just the other day I was listening into my 10-year-old's class and they talked about patience, right? How important patience is and that concept of patience in general. They also talk about courage, they talk about compassion and those types of things, right? And really take the time when they're spending online time together in that online classroom, talking about those things, right? So more like the social skills, I would say, and for me, the more important skills to actually develop. So I see many opportunities here in how we can now look at our education model in a different way. And hopefully, you know, that's going to continue,
Frederick,
moving forward.
You talked about opportunities and opportunities. That's something that you also offer to your colleagues and to your teams. And I want to begin with looking at your career. And we would like for you to explain your job title to us, because this is very interesting. You are Google's chief innovation evangelist. And when I first read that, I was like, what does that mean? What does the chief innovation evangelist do? Does this have something to do with opportunities as well?
In one way or the other, I would definitely say yes. So what I'm doing over the last couple of months is really helping individuals and whole organizations to really turn problems into opportunities, right? Where people see that, you know, some of these challenges just puts us into a state of being anxious and afraid, right? And literally locks our brains down. I'm trying to unlock those brains and say, like, you know, what is the opportunity here? What is the thing you can identify as a chance? And so doing that has been just, you know, for me, fascinating, because what I'm also seeing is that innovation, again, BC, before COVID, has been always, you know, the last item on the agenda, right? When you talk to teams or organizations, you know, and they prepared an agenda and you looked at the agenda, like innovation was always on there, but it was like the last thing on the agenda. And then usually people ran out of time and we said, like, oh, you know, let's do innovation tomorrow, right? Because we are successful and like everything is running perfectly and so forth. What I'm seeing now is that that turned upside down, right? Now innovation is at the top of the agenda and people and organizations want to spend a remarkably great amount of time to innovate. And that's my job, basically. You know, I help people innovate, doing that, you know, for our Googlers, you know, across the world, helping them to innovate, but also spreading the good news that everyone is creative and that we need to innovate now more than ever, right?
Talking about your journey to the US, and why does a guy from Ravensburg, born in Ravensburg in the south of Germany, knows how to teach other people how to innovate? How did you end up in the Valley becoming a chief innovation evangelist?
It's a great question. You know, I think, again, I truly believe that everyone is creative. And that probably just tells you that even if you're kind of like growing up in a small city in Germany, right, everyone has the ability to really influence other people, right, in a positive way, helping them to do some remarkable things, right? And so that was my passion from the beginning, is helping other people to innovate and to be creative. So I'm coming from a very safe, loving and caring environment, I have to say. You know, my family, you know, always, you know, cared a lot about, you know, children and like cared a lot about, you know, us as children growing up. And so I experienced a lot of safety, like psychological safety, right, at home. So I was able to explore a lot, right? I was able to go out, try many things and take risks, because I always knew that there's a safe place for me to go back to. So, you know, I set myself very early the goal to try to live in as many countries as possible, try to do as many jobs as possible and so forth. So that combination of safety that I experienced at home and knowing that there was always a place for me to go to or go back to, and with the confidence to try many things as possible, was more or less a prototyping approach to my career. Just trying many things and trying to learn as much as possible really quickly. And I think that helped me to explore many different fields. And so I was, you know, just learning a lot very quickly around, you know, innovation, around creativity, around leadership and so forth. And so I just continued with that passion to really work with people around the world to help them to be their best selves, right? And unleash their superpowers. Because we all have those superpowers, but it's really rare to see that individuals actually unleash their superpowers, right? On a daily basis. Superpowers like imagination, superpowers like empathy, superpowers like the ability to experiment, try things out, right? And so that was basically a passion for myself, and I just continued with that passion and tried as many jobs and lived in as many places as possible to really continue to learn. And that still is my philosophy around never doing things twice, right? So you rarely find myself living or staying in the same hotel. You rarely find myself going to a restaurant twice. And I think that also prepared me really well for change in general, right? So I was really probably well trained for, you know, what we all experience now in the lockdown, right? Because I basically prepared myself really to a changing, ever-evolving environment. And so I think everybody can train themselves more or less to see change as something constant that is constantly happening to us, but also change that can be initiated by us, right? So we are actually also agents of change, and we can drive that change moving forward and kind of like be that positive change we want to see happening in the world as well.
You joined Google, as far as I researched, when they were still a small company with an office, with a new office in Dublin. Can you take us into those early days of Google?
Yes. So I joined Google when we were about 17,000 people, I would say, globally. Now we are over 117,000 people, a little bit more than 117,000 people, full-time employees. And I joined in our Dublin office, in our European headquarters. And really in my first year, I traveled probably around 34 offices or even more, working with many teams on innovation. Really try to understand how teams innovate, how individuals innovate, and then trying to systematize innovation, trying to really come up with principles that help everyone around the world in our Google offices to innovate and do something radically different. And so that became, you know, my full-time job. And then I moved to Mountain View to our headquarters, doing, you know, innovation work with, you know, all of our teams globally. And so it kind of like just helped me to basically try to come up with a language for us at Google around innovation, a terminology we're using, but also coming up with principles, you know, we use to really innovate, I would say, with speed, right? And innovate in a respectful way so that we respect our users, you know, we respect the opportunity and we respect each other. That actually are our three values we operate under the three respects. And, you know, these are some of the things we continuously to use to innovate as well. And so I really was in a lucky position to be able to really define not just what innovation means for Google, but really help Googlers around the world to innovate and come up with these, you know, amazing technologies we see now around the world. And we now have, I think, 7 products in the market that touch about 1 billion users each. So quite a remarkable reach here. But we still have a long way to go. I think we still have to, you know, continue to innovate and really focus on what people around the world need now in times of a lockdown, in times of, you know, crises and so forth, and really being able to do that in a responsible way, in a respectful way as well. And so what I really can say is, for me, the three principles that help people innovate are empathy, expansive thinking, and experimentation, right? So if I would have to pick kind of like what are some of the most important skills for me for today and the future, empathy, expansive thinking, experimentation would probably be the ones. We really need to shift our mindset, right? We need to really turn problems into opportunities. We need to move out of a state of anxiety and being afraid of the challenges that are currently amongst us and that we are currently facing, and turn those into opportunities. And that's an easy thing to do. And the way to do that is by actually framing those problems as questions.
Is that how I can picture, how I can imagine what you do at Google? You see challenges, you talk to the teams, and you try to turn challenges into questions, and then find with the team the creative answers to those questions.
Absolutely, yes. So that's what I help teams to actually achieve. And so we most of the time start our times together, not with a brainstorm around ideas. We actually start with a question storming. So what are all the questions and problems we want to tackle, right? And listing those. And then it takes a couple of weeks to really frame questions in a good way, right? So that is a skill set I'm trying to build with more and more people, is the ability to frame good questions and turn problems into opportunities. And that's the first step towards innovation, right? Is actually moving away from a situation where you're facing a problem and your brain locks down into one that actually allows you to look into opportunities.
This is great.
Possibilities.
Then looking at the company you work for, what is Google's biggest challenge that you need to find answers to?
So the great news here is that we're probably never going to run out of challenges, right? We're never going to run out of problems, right? What I think matters is picking the right ones, right? Where do you want to invest your time and your resources in to really make a difference in the world, right? And that is a hard question, right? Because then you have to prioritize. Because you only have a limited amount of time and a limited amount of resources, right? So picking the right question is something I'm helping teams to actually do. And so that is really an exciting part, and it's a hard one too. And so moving into, like, you know, my world at Stanford, where I help students to actually frame those questions, right, and building those skills around question storming, for example, you would actually end up as a student in a situation where you don't have to present an answer or solution, but you have to present a question. And so in the last quarter, where I taught a course on innovation and creativity, we actually have allowed students to spend 4 to 5 weeks finding a good question and finding a good problem they want to spend their time on. So 4 to 5 weeks is a very long time, right, in a student life. And it was uncomfortable because most of the students actually reported back that this was one of the hardest courses they took, because it was very uncomfortable to not move into the solution space to come up with ideas, but stay in the problem space, stay in that space of, like, discovering the problem and exploring the problem from different perspectives and different angles as well, and then framing that question. And so at their final presentations, we allowed the students to build what we called a quest room, where they actually did an exhibit around questions, allowing them to show artifacts that basically brought that question to life. And so that was an exciting, like, 36 hours exhibit the students prepared, where basically everyone at Stanford could, and visitors could, go into that exhibit to really understand what are the questions students are asking themselves and how do they display those questions with artifacts. And, you know, remarkable questions were displayed. For example, one student actually who was focusing on suicide, right, and mental illness, basically had letters people were writing as, like, you know, goodbye letters to the world. He had kind of, like, you know, tucked them on the wall to display how people were thinking in their last hours before they killed themselves, right? And he wanted to point towards the problem of mental illness, right? And he wants to spend now, actually, kind of like the rest of his life to really find good solutions towards that problem of mental illness, right? But by basically putting that question out there, how can we as a society help individuals who suffer from mental illness in a better way, was a beautiful question to put there, because that really helped to understand that this is a relevant question on a global level and that we should probably spend more time around that question. Another student basically, she was basically putting five t-shirts on five different coat hangers, five different t-shirts. And she wanted to raise the question around, how can we produce clothing in a more sustainable way? And all of those t-shirts basically have listed, you know, how many hours were spent on producing those t-shirts, how many different people were involved, how many chemicals, and so forth, to really point towards that problem around clothing and how it's produced in a non-sustainable way. So it was just fascinating to go and browse through the different questions students came up with. And so that is a really fascinating experience I could create, co-create with the students. And that's also what I'm doing at Google, really helping people to turn problems into opportunities by first trying to figure out what is the problem we're trying to solve, and is that an important problem we should spend our time and resources on?
Frederick, I'm deeply touched by your explanation here personally, because I have spent the last probably 15 years, my entire professional life, around finding the right questions. And I never understood the connection between my craft of journalism that I went to school for and your craft of innovation until you just made that connection. And I had no idea that you would give people, from your students to your senior leadership at Google, so much time to figure that out. And I would assume that most people in their entire life will never have the time to spend so much energy and wisdom in such a well-facilitated way on finding the right question for themselves, which then leads to them reading, you know, Simon Sinek, Start with a Why, or other self-help books that are probably trying to help people finding questions in a different way. So what I wonder is, if you have, as a professional question finder, if you have a method that you can share with us that everybody can use in their lives, because this is something that extends to private life, to partnerships, to families, to friendships, to your social circle, to find and formulate the right questions. What are maybe the first three steps that you recommend every individual who wants to embark on this journey to find the best question?
Yes, I'm happy to share kind of like just a very easy like three-step process with you today. And everybody can do that. If you take a piece of paper, just fold it half, and then unfold it again. You have two columns. The left column for you is to really write down your problems, right? Things like I shared before, right? If you're a restaurant owner, you know, my clients and customers are not able to come into the restaurant anymore, right? That's a problem. Or, you know, my kids are not able to go to school and to, you know, educate them, you know, myself at home. That's another problem. Or as a leader, you can frame a problem around, I'm not able to connect with my team in person and understand, you know, what they need from me. So now you frame three problems on the left side of your piece of paper. What you now can do, and that's where most people get stuck, is move to the right side of your paper and frame questions based on the problems you just described. And you can do that by using the frame around how might we, right? Again, how might we reach our guests with food and drinks in a different way, if you're a restaurant owner? So you turn that problem into a question. The problem around schools are closed and our kids are not able to go to school, frame that as a question with how might we teach our children at home and see everyday things as learning opportunities. Third question, cannot meet with my team in person, not able to understand as a leader what my team needs from me. You can frame that as a question. How might I, as a leader, build trust and psychological safety in my team? So now you have three questions on your right side of the paper. Great questions. But what you can do as a third step is actually reframe those questions. And you can spend, you know, the next minutes, hours, and even days around framing and reframing those questions. Because those questions now already spark some interesting new ideas. But if you reframe those questions slightly, they might open up a tremendous wealth of opportunities and new ideas. So let me give you an example, probably one, you know, that everyone experienced over the last couple of months. So you could frame a question around, how might I design the best birthday party for my children, right? And now as we are not able to meet, right, and come together, people always focused on like the party element, right? So how can I design the best birthday party? You come up with probably like two, three great ideas. That's okay. If you reframe that question towards how might I celebrate the birthday of my child, you already see that your range of possibilities basically opens up. So you can look at very different ideas, not just a birthday party, but you can look at, you know, a drive-by kind of like celebration, for example, or a virtual kind of like, you know, sleepover. That might be another idea that comes up, and so forth. So by reframing from how might I design the best birthday party to how might I celebrate a birthday, that slight reframe basically allowed you to come up with very different and sometimes, you know, radically new ideas as well. So that reframing is the third step that is kind of like, you know, really helping us to look at problems in a very different way. And so writing down your problems, turning them into questions, and then doing a reframing is a three-step process that basically jumpstart your innovation capabilities right away. And, you know, we always see that people are really coming up with really interesting and novel solutions very quickly. But we need to spend time in those three steps, because most of us, we're just gonna be locked down literally in the first step where we face these problems, and then our brain basically closes down and we, you know, face anxiety and are afraid basically because we cannot jump out of that problem and frame that as a question. So for me, when, you know, COVID-19 happened or, you know, other situations are happening, I trained myself, right, to really frame the problem and then turn that into a question and then see the opportunity in that immediately. So it really helps me to continue to innovate and, you know, think about creative ideas more rapidly and quickly as well.
How do you organize a question storming in your team? How long does it need to be? How many people do need to attend? So is there a limit on quantity?
For me, what I find is that it's very uncomfortable for most people to spend time framing questions. It's an ability we have as children, but we somehow unlearn on the way when we grow up, right? Because for most of us, it just doesn't feel right to ask questions, right? And sometimes we lack of the psychological safety in our teams that we're actually able to raise questions and ask the hard questions, right? So that is probably a good way of starting off, is building psychological safety and building trust in the team so that you're actually able to frame questions and that you're allowed to ask questions, right? And then the exercise of question storming and asking the right questions, I think can follow the same rules as brainstorming, right? You know, go wild, right? Trying to be visual, build on each other's questions, right? So yes and is also like a foundational principle that can be applied here. And defer judgment, right? So you should actually allow yourself to ask questions. And so I think the same rules to a brainstorm apply here in a question storm as well. Again, what we see is that teams usually make that mistake that they spend most of their time around ideation, brainstorming, and finding answers to questions, and not spend enough time on framing the right questions. And again, what I shared from our students at Stanford and like teams I work with, you know, across the world in various organizations, for them it's very uncomfortable and very unusual to spend a significant amount of time to do that exploration work, exploring the questions and asking the right questions as well.
Frederick, as one more journalistic question on questions here. So for question beginnings, you have the how, the what, the why, the who, the when. And as a journalist, it's sometimes very hard to go away from like the why and the what. So there are certain kinds of questions that are being totally underused, for example, when or who. How do you find that in your process? Do you have a favorite beginning that is maybe totally underrated for a question, like a question side word that we tend to use not often enough, that we should use more to find the right question?
Perfect. That's a great question, Felix. I think, you know, you're the expert probably here as well, you know, as you're thinking about that, specifically in the context of journalism. What I would say is that when you ask the question, what, a follow-up question should be, so what? So that is kind of like, for me, an interesting point around the agency we should feel when we find an answer, right? So what are we going to do next, right? Because what I feel is that we all have these abilities to come up with, you know, very innovative ideas. Everybody has that ability, right? We think about 20,000 ideas a day. So we're not lacking of ideas. But sometimes we are lacking of the agency combined with the courage to actually move those ideas forward. Start an experiment, try something new, try something different, and so forth. And so I think what we are experiencing right now is that we all have a little bit more agency and say like, oh, I actually have to do something different. I have to experiment. I have to actually try something radically new, even on a small scale, because, you know, I just have to, right? There is no way around it. So I have to kind of like, you know, use different forms of education at home, right, for example, or I have to serve my customers in a different way now, or I have to connect with my team virtually. And so I think what we see now is that people are more willing to experiment and try things. And we also see that people are more willing to forgive if it's not perfect, right? And move away from that sense of like everything has to be perfect in the first place, right? So I think an addition I would have to a question, specifically if we ask what, is the so what, right? So that's the action we should take afterwards. Again, the agency combined with courage is a beautiful frame of like, you know, let's not just look at those ideas and put them on a whiteboard or a post-it, but actually turn those ideas into an experiment and actually get it out into the world to see what happens.
Frederick, I have to follow up with a what here. You came to the Silicon Valley in 2011, so you have spent significant time there, almost a decade. When you look back now on your, you know, on the part of your life that has played out in the Silicon Valley as a German in this international, very diverse, of course, high competition, high talent space, what did you personally have to unlearn when you came? What did you bring that you have to unlearn in order to become who you are now?
I think most of my assumptions were challenged when I came over to the Silicon Valley. Again, like I traveled around quite a bit in terms of like not just traveling with a backpack, but like actually trying to live in different places, like South Africa, like Shanghai, and many other places to really understand, you know, how people think and work and live and play in those different areas of the world, and really continue on a personal learning journey. And so I think some of my assumptions were challenged here in Silicon Valley, and I think that's a good thing. I think everybody should challenge their own assumptions every day, because that's a very helpful thing to do. One thing I think I, not unlearned, but like I figured out really quickly is that, you know, I always thought like everybody knows exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it, which is not the case. And so I think for me, figuring out like what am I doing and why I'm doing these things was important to really, again, like putting my time against the highest priorities and really helping, you know, individuals, teams and whole organizations to innovate. Used to be my mission, is still my mission moving forward. And then figuring out like where can I invest my time so that, you know, it has most impact, right, as well. And so, you know, things have changed in Silicon Valley, and I think, you know, many things have changed to the positive, I would say, right? A big focus now on inclusion and diversity, right? And actually putting that front and center, I think, is very important and very healthy, specifically for us in the tech industry. Also, I think now, for speaking of Google, you know, Google is now a young adult, if you, you know, would speak in those terms of a human being, like being 21, right? You're a young adult. Having 7 products that reach 1 billion users each, you know, we also have a big responsibility in the world, right? So we see that responsibility actually as well. But we want to maintain the positive aspects of a young adult, right? That curiosity, that explorer mindset, and so forth. While at the same time balancing that with, you know, being respectful and actually understanding where we can make a difference, and doing that in a very thoughtful and responsible way as well. So for me, kind of like, you know, what has been front and center, and hopefully I have contributed to that a little bit at least in Silicon Valley, is that openness and optimism, right? And I think if you have openness and optimism together, right, I think that's a really fantastic formula for innovation, right? Being open to new things, being open to, you know, different perspectives, being open to different questions, and so forth. But also being optimistic, right? Turning problems into opportunities. Combining that with a specific level of ambition to make a positive difference in the world, I think is something I still continue to see here in Silicon Valley. And that's something I want to promote also as an innovation evangelist around the world.
Would you say the most creative people are the most optimistic ones?
For me, everyone is creative. So what we are lacking is not creativity as human beings, it's confidence, right? And that courage to turn ideas into actions. And so what I've seen with the most successful innovators is that they not just are able to come up with fantastic, great ideas, but they're actually turning them into experiments. They have the courage to try something and to continue to learn, right? And so stepping out of your comfort zone and doing something different and radically new is something you can practice and train yourself in. And I hope that more and more people are actually doing that. Combining that with a level of empathy, having deep empathy for people's needs and understanding of other people's thoughts and feelings, putting yourself into somebody else's shoes, literally, is what I've seen like the best innovators do quite well.
Frederick, thank you so much for spending time here with us. We totally went over time because there's a lot to unpack. I have a last question for you that we ask everybody on this podcast. And this last question dives into your music brain. What song makes you, Frederick Pferd, feel wunderbar?
That's a great question. So I feel wunderbar most of the time. So just want to put that out there, specifically if I'm together with, you know, others. So I think, you know, the brand Wunderbar Together is spot on here. I would say what makes me probably Wunderbar is when I'm able to listen to different songs every time, right? So really listening to new and other songs that I haven't listened to. So that probably is something that makes me feel wunderbar.
Wunderbar, wunderbar.
So thank you very much, Frederick Pferd, Chief Innovation Evangelist at Google. Thank you for teaching us. Thank you for sharing some of your craft. Thank you for giving us hands-on advice. It really felt like a workshop at times, more than a conversation. Thank you so very much. Thanks to Peter Took, our producer. Thanks to Olli Nemmerlich, who was a fabulous co-host again today, kind of our German correspondent in Cologne, with me being in New York, that is making the Wunderbar Together picture complete here. Thanks to this amazing initiative, Wunderbar Together, that inspired and supports this podcast. Check them out at wunderbartogether.org. And if you would like, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting service. Leave us a comment. And look for Frederick's work. It's all out there on the web. There's a lot of blog posts and videos that you can check out on how to be more creative in the Google way. This was Wunderbar Together. My name is Felix Zeltner. Stay wunderbar and see you soon. Bye bye.
Down on the Jungfrau from our secret chalet for two. Let us drink Liebchen mein in the moonlight benign to the joy of our dream come true. La 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 la.